Hello and welcome to another episode of Consumer, the European podcast of the Consumer Choice Center. I'm your host, Bill Wirtz, and as always, it's Billy Joel's Pressure fading out in the background. This is the episode of April 15, 2021. Today I read that it's tax day in America, so our American listeners, make sure you've paid all of your infrastructure, as the new administration likes to call it. Announcement, our friends from the World Vapers Alliance are celebrating World Vape Day on May 30th. The motto this year is Go the Extra Mile, and there will be a whole live-streamed event on Facebook. You can go find that on the Facebook page of World Vapers Alliance or under the website worldvapersalliance.com. My guest this week is my Consumer Choice Center colleague Fabio Fernandez. He's usually in the background of our operations because he does a lot of our social media marketing, but he's felt the real effects of social media advertising restrictions, so I wanted to bring him on to talk about that and how exactly that works and what that means for nonprofit organizations such as the Consumer Choice Center. Also in this episode, the Netherlands is experimenting with mass events. My colleague Fred Roeder took a flight to nowhere, and halloumi cheese is protected. Yes, that's more serious of a conversation than you might think. So let's get started. The Dutch government is experimenting with large-scale events such as cabaret shows, a conference, dance festivals, football matches, and others. These are so-called Type 1 events and would be held indoors and seated. Even though I'm having a hard time imagining how a dance festival would be seated, I suppose for the first time I would also be counted as a good dancer in that kind of setting. The research so far has shown that these events can be organized if security features are respected. This is all in light of the Eurovision Song Contest 2021, which is supposed to take place in Rotterdam, the Netherlands, in about a month from now. Here's the BBC reporting on the first experiment in the Netherlands last month.
Our music festival is going ahead in the Netherlands this weekend, despite the rest of the country being under a COVID-19 lockdown. The two-day event is an experiment to try to work out whether there is a safe way to allow large social gatherings without increasing the spread of the virus. But with the average number of new infections in the country up by 25% since last week, questions are being asked about the wisdom of holding a festival during a pandemic.
With the results being in now, it does indeed work. So good on the Dutch for making that reality. It's really important that we realize how tough the times have been for all types of entertainers, event places, and so on. You know, myself, I'm not really hit by the pandemic, apart from the traveling restrictions and the fact that I'm, you know, quite a social person, so I do like to go out. But, you know, other people are really hit professionally, and it's not just shops and so on. It's really this, we have a huge event industry, event organizers, entertainers, and so on, and it's so tough for them to not have a regular income now because many of them are self-employed. And I really think that it's an upside to be able to imagine having that kind of thing again, that DJs and artists and all types of entertainers can get back to work. I also think that, you know, if you look at this particular festival, it's mostly young people, and young people are not in that vulnerable group that we're trying to protect. So I think it does make sense that events can come back. I just feel like that this is really an uptake that we need to see. We need to see more of this. And whether you call it an experiment or not, I don't really care. I just really want events to be back on. In other news then, my colleague Fred Roeder took a flight to nowhere, an exclusive trip with the airline Emirates, which departed from Dubai International Airport only to return to Dubai International Airport. This was the first flight with fully vaccinated passengers. I asked Fred how that went. You recently took the very first flight that was with fully vaccinated people. What happened there exactly? Tell us how it went.
It was interesting. So Emirates Airlines organized the flight on Saturday, which was called EK2021. And it was on the new Airbus A380. That's a double-decker, largest passenger plane on the market and in human history. And they asked people if they want to join for a flight for about 3.5 hours, just taking off in Dubai and landing in Dubai, just to basically demonstrate that flying can be safe. And I got a ticket and went on it.
And so how do they confirm that you are indeed vaccinated?
Yeah, so basically during the check-in process, which you had to do in person, So you could not do any online check-in. You had to go to the airport, and then you had to show your vaccine certificate. And they said either a text message from the vaccination center or the paper slip, or just a picture of the paper slip or the email you got. So they were fairly relaxed with what form of medium you used to prove it, which was relieving to me. You just show it and then you get your boarding pass. But after that, you still had to take a rapid test at the airport. You didn't have to pay for it, but still it was two nose swabs, and you had to wait and sit there for 10 minutes till they call your name and tell you, okay, you're negative and you can now proceed and go through security. Yeah, so you had to be fully vaccinated and to get tested.
And so how is the conversation with other passengers on board? I assume you made some conversation, and how is the behavior? Because, you know, right now when I take flights, some people are very careful, you know, try to keep their distance in a way, try to get off the plane in a certain orderly manner. How does that evolve once everyone's vaccinated?
It was interesting. So, I mean, definitely people who went on that flight to nowhere didn't have to go anywhere. So they were just curious about trying it out and being back in the skies in a nice plane for a couple of hours. And actually, while being in flight, the pilot decided to stay another hour and circle over the UAE. So we spent a bit more time in kerosene enjoying the views. But there were definitely passengers, including myself, who were a bit surprised that you had to take the rapid test. And then we also had to wear a mask all the time, which, you know, then the question is, okay, there's, of course, a value to get vaccinated because the likelihood you get COVID is much lower and the likelihood you give it to someone who's vulnerable is much, much lower. So that is definitely a benefit. But then the question is, why does everyone still need to wear masks? And why do we need to have to go to the airport an extra hour early to take the test? So that was a bit unfortunate. And I got to talk to the COO of Emirates on the flight and also ask him about this critical case. When can we get rid of these things? Because that just adds cost, time and money, and then also the travel experience, right? Because having to wear a mask all the time is just not very comfortable.
Right, and I will be playing some excerpts from that interview you did. One last question. I was a bit curious because you got a Chinese vaccine in Dubai. Are you worried in any way that this might be a problem when you try and travel back to Europe if this specific vaccine will not be recognized as one of the official ones that you can use to travel?
Initially, I was a bit worried. I mean, it looks like the EU did not get enough, their hands not on sufficient Western manufactured vaccines. So I believe some member states already started using the Russian vaccine and some of the Chinese vaccines. Then it would be very hard for the EU not to accept that if even some of their own citizens got vaccinated and their governments procured them with such vaccines. Obviously, I would have preferred to get an mRNA vaccine. It looks that Pfizer among youngsters has efficacy of like 100%, which is amazing. But it was just not available to me. And better some protection than no protection.
Here's also a clip of the interview that Fred did on the flight with Chief Operating Officer of Emirates Airlines, Adel Al Reda.
We are an Emirates, was one of the company who have taken advantage of that. And we are able to today say that more than 85% of our flight crew and cabin crew have taken the vaccination. This is to ensure a safe travel, to ensure that we are protected, to protect our...
You can watch the entire interview on the YouTube channel of the Consumer Choice Center and make sure to subscribe to stay up to date on our latest videos. In other news then, Cypriot halloumi cheese is now a protected product under the rules of the European Union. Producers can now only use the term halloumi if it describes this specific cheese from Cyprus. By the way, that being either the Republic of Cyprus or the non-recognized Republic of Northern Cyprus. The EU agriculture chief Janusz Wojciechowski said, and I quote, "This registration arrangement ensures equal and fair treatment for all producers on each side of the green line and will finally guarantee that consumers throughout the EU can identify this authentic Cypriot product." As Politico reports, quote, protecting halloumi cheese with a geographical indication has long been touted by the European Commission and former President Jean-Claude Juncker as a key to advance reunification of the Turkish and Greek zones of the island of Cyprus, end of quote. So you see how much cheese can actually unite people in the Mediterranean. Here's a Reuters report.
Cheesemaker George Petrou said this reaffirms what the industry has been saying for years, that halloumi is Cypriot, potentially dating back as far as 1500.
Unfortunately, in recent years, many countries tried to copy us. So the registration for this status, this result that we have today, will help very much in that other countries will not produce halloumi or something similar, which misleads customers.
Petrou first started selling halloumi in 1982, using 250 litres of milk a day. Now his company processes 250 tons of milk per day, employs 220 people and exports to 40 countries.
So if you're now eating halloumi cheese, you'll know it's the real Cypriot deal, and you actually know that it might be contributing to peace in the Mediterranean, so that's good news. But now let's move on to the interview of this week. My guest is my colleague Fabio Fernandez. He is the Global Communications Manager here at the Consumer Choice Center. He deals with our social media work, and he knows firsthand how much more difficult it's gotten over the years to promote content online. Fabio, you do a lot of our social media work, so you know the practicalities of online marketing, online advertising. How exactly does anyone who has an organization or a page on Facebook or elsewhere, how does it exactly work to be able to sponsor content?
So hi, Bill. So social media today is very different from what it was 10 years ago. So when I started, social media was kind of this new thing. And basically, people were posting things in the organic way. So they were creating content, creating a community, a base of fans, followers, and etc. And that was the way that you had another option to communicate with people that are interested in your brand or in the purpose of your organization. And that's basically how social media started 10 years ago, a way that people and marketers were trying to get away from traditional media, especially TV. That was very expensive, and they found that they had this new opportunity to reach directly consumers. And that's how basically we started with social media advertising. It was an organic communication. But then social media companies, basically big tech, saw that they had a lot of information about consumers, and they could sell this database for companies and organizations that were interested in reaching them. And they started selling those packages so you could create a corporate or a business page on Facebook, for example, or you could have on Twitter or LinkedIn. And then on these pages, you could select the customer's base that you wanted to reach, and you could pay to reach those. And basically today, that's how it works. You have to, you need to have a business account, and depending on what kind of advertising you're running on those platforms, you need different kinds of registration and verification. So particularly for political and social issues advertising, it's very restricted. If you take, for example, Twitter ad policies, they ban completely political advertising, and they have some restrictions to cause-based advertising, which means that all advertisings on those kind of topics, they are reviewed by third-party people or employees of Twitter. For Facebook, it's a little bit different. Facebook allows election and politics. You are required to have a disclaimer. Basically, also we have to respect blackout periods, which is between elections or legislation, basically in different countries. And you have some kind of reporting requirements with the amount of budget that you spend on those issues or political advertising. And there's a lot of control, especially if you're advertising for political candidates pre and after elections.
So what exactly happens if Facebook thinks that you're in violation? What exactly does Facebook tell you, and what happens to your posts?
Yeah, so basically to run those kind of advertisers, you need to be registered and you need to be a resident of the location where you're running those ads. So for example, if you're in the United States, you need to be a US citizen or you need to be a resident of the US, and you need to prove with documentation and government document that you live there. And once you start running those kind of advertisements on, for example, Facebook, there is basically a flow that you would follow. So you can submit your artwork, your text and everything to Facebook as you would as a normal business. But if Facebook detects that some of the words are political related or social issue related, they would automatically ban and restrict your advertising, your ad, and then you can request for a review. So basically it is divided in two. They have automatically, which is a bot that automatically reviews a lot of the content that is published by advertisers, but they also have a person review. Usually the person review is reserved for a second check. So if someone requests a review, usually goes to someone that will actually look at it and say if it's approved or not. Different platforms have different periods to look this over. So Facebook, I believe it's 7 days, they have to check that. I tried many times to review some of the content that I created on Facebook, but it was never override. So which means that what was automatically set by the bot, hardly it's going to be reviewed or changed by a person looking at it.
And so just for also the users to understand, because there's this big conversation about which data is actually used. So when you try to target certain audiences, which categories do you have to select from? I assume you have like man, woman, age groups, but what else is there that you get as an option to choose from?
Yeah, so basically it's demographics. Like you said, you can choose if it's a male, female, the age, location, so everything demographic related. And they are very specific. You can target, be very precise in the kind of selection you're making, but also they have behavior and interests. And those are the things that basically you publish yourself or you put yourself on Facebook or Twitter, interests that you have, pages that you follow, and they can categorize this, and they use AI to kind of see what are the trends and what do you like and those kind of things, the kind of content that you're interested in. And they put you in these different brackets. But also they have the third-party advertising network, which means that if you have cookies from Facebook, Google, Twitter, they share this information regarding you. They don't know from Google and Facebook, they don't know which person is this. They don't name or they don't link with your direct account. But they are able to see that from the cookie on your browser or for the IP address of your computer, they can see that this is the same person. And they can gather all this information about yourself and then can use this to sell your information to advertisers. So basically what Facebook says is that they are not directly selling your information to advertisers, but they are actually putting you into brackets and different brackets of interests and behaviors that you have. And they are selling those brackets or those packages of people to advertisers.
Right. And that's a good clarification to understand how exactly that data is used. It's not that everybody receives an Excel sheet with all of our personal information. It's more used for advertising purposes and to different degrees. So how do different social media platforms compare? So what would you say is like the difference between a platform like Facebook and a platform like LinkedIn?
So as we mentioned before, so Twitter doesn't allow any political advertising. So this is one big difference. Different platforms have different policies and they allow different things into their platforms. LinkedIn, I would say, is the most open platform to do basically whatever you want in terms of advertising. But since it's very career or work-related community, the type of people that are usually navigating in this specific platform is different from the one that it's on Instagram. So you also have to think on the needs of the consumers and the need of the advertiser when they are trying to reach those people. But basically, LinkedIn everybody knows it costs much more than Facebook and Twitter because you have a more qualified base of people. So people that are actually, you know, they are basically everyone in LinkedIn is a real person. You don't have this kind of problem on LinkedIn that you have on Facebook or Twitter, that you have bots and people that you don't know if they're real, because everyone that it's on LinkedIn, actually, they have a career profile, they have a CV and all this information that goes with it. So LinkedIn knows that, and they sell the information, or they sell their space for advertisers for a much higher price. So, but Facebook has the broader, I would say, network that you can advertise on, because they have the Facebook, they have Instagram, they have all the network display that it's attached also to this. And also they have stories, reels, and all those products. They are expanding to see how WhatsApp could play a role on this. So Facebook has a lot of products, much more than Twitter, for example, and then they also can deliver your advertising to more people because they can reach them in more places. So the same person is using Facebook in the morning and Instagram in the afternoon, and they can impact you in both times and in different times of the day in different platforms.
That makes sense, and it's interesting to see the differences between the platforms. Now, so the restrictions you were mentioning earlier, in essence, the goal is noble. We don't want to have fake news. We don't want to have misinformation on these platforms, but they also impact people that don't try to do any of this. So from your experience, especially at the Consumer Choice Center, how do you see the impact? How do you think it's fairly enforced?
So the first thing, I think it's important to define what is social issue by Facebook advertising policies. So Twitter doesn't allow anything related to politics, only cause-based ads. But for Facebook, it's any sensitive topic that are heavily debated, may influence the outcome of an election, or result in or relate to existing or proposed legislation, which means that anything goes in this kind of arena. So in my experience with different countries is, I think that different countries enforce Facebook policies a different way. And I see this also in other social media platforms. But basically I would say that the United States and Europe, they are very restrict and they enforce those policies much heavily than, for example, when we do campaigns in Brazil or Mexico and countries that I think don't have legislation that it's so heavy on those on big tech and regulating fake news and those things. Also, something that I see is that big organizations such as BLM, so Black Lives Matter, Greenpeace, Bloomberg Philanthropies, and even government branches such as the European Commission, they have a free pass. So they have a free pass to do whatever they want in social media. They can talk about climate change. They can talk about vaping. They can talk about any other product that brands and smaller organizations can't. So this is important because there's no doubt that there are social issues that need to be enforced by Facebook policies. But you see that there is a huge difference between big advertisers on Facebook, because Bloomberg Philanthropies and Greenpeace, they spend a lot of money, millions of dollars in advertising every year, and smaller organizations that don't have those kind of cash, and they don't have a representative inside Facebook, for example, that it can reach and ask for a review on their content. So this situation, I think it's bad for consumers because they are misinformed and they only have access to one side of the narrative. And it's bad for the democratic debate because if you take climate change, for instance, and Greenpeace, on the work that Greenpeace is doing on that, there is no hard evidence that climate change is associated with human behavior. And you could call this a fake news, but it goes along with the narrative that big tech is trying to push about climate change. So everything that you have that may disagree with those kind of narratives can be labeled as fake news. So if you get a more left-wing newspaper or a news outlet, for example, as Vox, they will say that 70% of all content on social media is fake news. But they absolutely consider everything that goes against their narrative to be fake news. And they don't consider their narrative that sometimes have flawed research and distorted research that could be also labeled as fake news. So I think this is an interesting debate because you can go along in this narrative and it's important to make the distinction between the two.
Both sides of the political aisle are upset, interestingly. Both the left and the right actually say that they feel discriminated in some sense from the big social media platforms. Both seem to agree that these platforms have become too powerful and too big. And on both sides of the Atlantic, there are new rules being made. Before this interview, we talked briefly about the United States, and there was Justice Thomas recently deciding that, well, it could be considered that these big social media platforms are public utilities and they should be governed and regulated as communications companies, for instance. Now, how do you see that? Is the government the right actor to solve the issue on the political debate on social media? Can they make the rules that allow us to have a more open conversation on these platforms?
I think this is the million-dollar question right now. So if you take the United States, they are discussing now about Section 230, which is basically the immunity that social media platforms and big tech has to not be responsible for the content that is being published on there. But now they are basically working and running as an editorial platform, as a publishing, that Section 230 would not apply if they were categorized as an editorial or a publication like a newspaper. So you mentioned Judge Thomas' decision, which was released this month. It is a very important one because actually the history on that is that in 2017, Donald Trump was sued because he was banning or blocking people that were trolling the real Donald Trump account on Twitter. And in 2019, the decision was that real Donald Trump was actually an official public space because it was the official channel that the president of the United States was communicating with the public. So actually what the instance in New York and the judges in New York decided is that the account real Donald Trump was an official public space. And then in 2020, Twitter banned Donald Trump's account. So that makes a very interesting discussion because now Judge Thomas is the point that he's making is actually that if the official account of the president, which was real Donald Trump, we're not talking about the White House account on Twitter, we're talking Donald Trump's personal account that was used to talk on Twitter. And if it was decided that this was an official public space, and then now Twitter has the power to ban an official public space, that makes Twitter and all social media platforms actually public utilities. I don't personally agree with this decision. I think we are closer to getting to an agreement with the Section 230 and also enforcing that if big tech is working as an editorial or a publisher, they need to be responsible for the kind of content they are moderating. And I think we are closer to an agreement and on that side. But I think to imagine that social media platforms and big tech can somehow be related to a public utility like a telephone company, I think this is much further, and we are much further from getting to a conclusion and an agreement on that.
And that concludes this week's episode of Consumer. Thank you so much for listening. You can find Fabio's Twitter handle in the description of this episode. Also, if you want to support this podcast, make sure to make a donation to the Consumer Choice Center at consumerchoicecenter.org/donate. As always, I'm your host, Bill Wirtz. See you Thursday.
You have to learn to pace yourself. Pressure. You're just like everybody.